We are talking today with Dean Baker. Dean Baker is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He has worked as a consultant for the World Bank, the Joint Economic Committee of the U.S. Congress, and the OECD's Trade Union Advisory Council. His columns have appeared in many major media outlets, including the Atlantic Monthly, the Washington Post, the London Financial Times. He is author of numerous books, including The United States Since 1980, Social Security, The Phony Crisis, co-authored with Mark Weisbrot, The Benefits of Full Employment, co-authored with Jared Bernstein, Getting Prices Right, The Battle Over the Consumer Price Index, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He appears frequently on TV and radio programs, including CNN, CBS News, PBS NewsHour, and National Public Radio. And he has a blog, Beat the Press, which features commentary on economic reporting. Dean, thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Thanks a lot for having me on. I should also mention I have one more book coming out, The Plunder and Blunder, The Rise and Fall of the Bubble Economy, which should be out in early January.
Excellent. So start out, and as we tape this, we are currently in the what appears to be the beginning stages of the Paulson-Bernanke bailout. Can you give us your assessment of how that is going?
Yeah, the bailout's very problematic. I mean, we have to distinguish between what I think is the legitimate purpose of the bailout and what's totally illegitimate. The legitimate purpose of the financial sector bailout is to keep the financial industry intact. We don't want to see a financial meltdown. We don't want to see our financial system just collapse. We want to be able to go to our ATM and get money out of it. We want to be able to use checks, credit cards. I mean, this is, you know, our system's dependent on that. We have to keep the financial system operating. But we have no interest in helping out the shareholders who bought stock in these companies. You know, they lost money, and that's the way it goes. That's the way a market economy is supposed to work. They don't write checks to us when they make lots of money on their Citibank stock or Merrill Lynch, whatever it might be. When things go badly, they're supposed to pay the price. So we have no interest in bailing out the shareholders. The people we really have no interest in bailing out are the executives of these companies, many of whom made tens of millions, in some cases hundreds of millions of dollars, doing the practices that brought this on. They made really bad loans. They made really risky loans. They highly leveraged their institutions. We have zero interest in doing anything for these people. And the problem with the bailouts to date is that they haven't distinguished between the legitimate purpose of the bailout, that, you know, we want to keep these banks operating so that we don't have a collapse of the system, and giving money to shareholders, giving money to executives. And that's really outrageous in my mind, because when you do that, what that means is we're taxing ordinary people, firefighters, school teachers, typical workers. We're taxing these people to give money to some of the absolute richest people in the country. And worst of all, we're giving it to them precisely because they did their jobs badly. So it's pretty hard to justify taxing the school teacher in Iowa so you could pay Robert Rubin's salary of $20 million a year or whatever he might be getting this year. So we should have been putting very serious conditions on these bailouts. We should have basically, in many cases, just taken over the company. Citigroup has now gotten their second bailout. They got $25 billion from Henry Paulson back in November, and now they just got a second bailout where we, in effect, gave them enough money to buy the company. You know, we did that as a loan we'll collect interest on, not very high interest, but we could have just owned the company outright, and there's really no reason we should not at that point, and basically told the shareholders, we're sorry, you're out of luck, and told the executives, Robert Rubin, the rest of the people that brought the bank to ruin, that, you know, you're going to have to look for work elsewhere, and brought in people at much lower pay. We don't have to pay people tens of millions of dollars, particularly when they're running the bank into the ground. You could get better people who don't wreck financial institutions. So that would be my big complaints on the bailouts, that they haven't been focused narrowly on the legitimate purpose of simply keeping the system running. And instead, we've basically rewarded the people who got us here.
So is there any way at this point in time to make those corrections?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, for better or worse, we're only halfway through at best. I mean, these institutions have really bad losses. They have many more on the books that are going to be coming. I mean, we're entering a really serious downturn. Obviously, it's centered in the housing market, but that's nowhere near at the end of the housing market. But on top of that, the downturn itself is going to create bad debt elsewhere in the economy, much of which is going to show up in one manner or another on the books of these banks. So in the case of the housing market, there's people focused on subprime, and that was the sort of leading edge of it. But there's hundreds of billions of dollars of bad debt in prime mortgages that no one's written down yet because it hasn't been incurred. You have all these people around the country that owe, say, $400,000 on a home that's worth $250,000. They might be paying their mortgages. No one's written that off. No, they're paying their mortgage. They're current on their mortgage. What's going to happen, though, is that people move. You know, their family situations, their job situations, people move fairly frequently. So a lot of these people, in 6 months, a year, 2 years, they're going to be selling their home. They'll get $250,000. They owe the bank $400,000. They don't have $150,000 to pull out of the bank, so the bank's going to have a short sale where they write off a loss of $150,000. There's going to be hundreds of thousands, probably millions of instances like that. So there's a lot of bad loans in real estate yet to come. Commercial real estate, there was a bubble there, not as bad as in residential, but that is now bursting. So there's loans on the books that were made to builders to build shopping malls, office buildings. They're going to take very big hits there. And then simply because of the downturn and the loss of housing equity, you're going to see much higher default rates on other forms of consumer debt, credit card debt, car loans, student loans. All these are going to go bad at rates we've never seen before. So there's a massive wave of bad debt yet to hit the banks. So they are going to need more money, and certainly we could use that as an opportunity to basically lay down the law to these banks that, you know, we're not helping out your shareholders, we're certainly not helping out your executives, we're going to change the way you guys do business.
So is that something you think there's a chance of getting Henry Paulson to make the right call on, or do we have to wait till the next administration comes in?
Well, this is going to be going on over, you know, many, many months, and probably all through 2009 and quite likely into 2010. So Henry Paulson, for better or worse, isn't going to be here for most of this. I don't think Henry Paulson's in any, even thinking about changing the course of the bailouts to date. You know, he's got 40 days left at this point or thereabout. I really doubt he's even giving a thought to changing qualitatively what he's been doing to date. I think he's probably making plans for, you know, his vacation after Inauguration Day or, you know, what he does in his subsequent career. So I don't expect Henry Paulson to be changing what he's doing. It's really the next administration we have to look to.
All right. Talk also about the big three automakers bailout. What are your thoughts on that? And is that just the beginning of other industries coming forward and looking for handouts?
Well, the big three, I think, are really unique. The auto sector, the domestic auto sector, is still very important to the economy as a whole, but it's hugely important to the states where it's centered, Ohio, Indiana, and first and foremost, Michigan. And if you were to let those companies go under at this time, I mean, if we're talking about 2 years ago when the economy is reasonably healthy, or, you know, let's say 3 years down the road, 4 years down the road when we could hope it again be healthy, perhaps you'd allow them to go under. But at this time, where these economies are already reeling, if you were to let those companies go under, you'd just be devastating. You talk about an outright depression in those three states. And you'd have to have billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars, keeping Detroit, Michigan, Ohio, making it so people aren't, you know, homeless, able to afford heat in the winter. I mean, we'd have to rescue those regions. So it's a question of how do you do this at the least cost, the least pain. So I don't really think there's an argument except that we have to bail them out for now. So I think we absolutely have to do that. And, you know, there's plenty of complaints, many of them quite legitimate, directed at the industry. They focused on producing these big SUVs that were gas guzzlers, and they did this as very short-sighted. They said, we're making money on this today. We're going to keep doing that. We don't want to try to build small fuel-efficient cars, and their logic was, well, everyone's doing that. They'd have to compete head-to-head with Toyota and the Korean companies and all these other manufacturers. So they took the easy route. They did short-term thinking, and now they're paying a really big price for it. So, you know, you could say they deserve their fate in that sense, but the people of Michigan don't deserve that fate. The workers there don't deserve that fate. So I think it's absolutely essential that we do a bailout, and, you know, we should take advantage of that opportunity, just as I was saying with the banks, that we change the way they do business. If we're giving them money, we lay down the law. One thing, your executives are not going to get $20 million a year. That was the pay that Malay, the chief executive of Ford, was getting. Well, you know, we could bring that pay down to earth, you know, $1 million, $2 million, whatever we might decide is reasonable. And if that's not enough for him, he could go, we'll get someone else to do it, you know, so we don't need him. So get the pay down to earth and then say, you know, you're going to junk your SUVs. You're going to be producing fuel-efficient cars. You're going to be producing electric cars, hybrid cars. That's the way of the future, and, you know, you don't have a choice in it. You're taking our money. That's the deal. So I think we have to go that route. In terms of other industries, obviously people are going to line up. And, you know, my view would be to take a very critical look at all of them. But, you know, with the idea in just about every case, you're probably going to say no. Thankfully, I can't think of other industries on the face of it that are that central to the U.S. economy or even to a regional economy as the big three are to the Midwest, the Michigan, Ohio, Indiana region. So I think we should take a critical eye. I don't want to say a blanket no to everything, but the presumption should be that we don't want to bail out every company that comes through the door.
The corporate media has generally been anti-union, and with the big three bailout, the unions have been getting a lot of play for being overly compensated with the big three. Do you think that's true?
Well, auto workers get good pay, and I think that's a good thing. You know, the pay of an auto worker, their base pay is about $27, $28 an hour, which that's decent pay. You're doing a lot better than working at Walmart, you know, getting 9 or 10 an hour. You also have health care. You also have pension. I think those are the jobs we should want people to have. You know, it's hard to say that's living the good life. I mean, that's the annual pay for an auto worker is less than what Robert Rubin made wrecking Citibank every single day he worked there. So it's a little hard for me to look at an auto worker who gets $57,000 a year and get really upset that that's too much money. I know, you know, I live in Washington, and the Washington Post there has had at least three editorials where they just were just, you know, outraged that auto workers are getting $57,000 a year. I think that just speaks volumes about the class bias, because I really doubt any of the people who wrote that would consider a job that pays $57,000 a year. So I don't think that's too much pay. Now, part of the story of the problem of the auto industry is their benefits, their health care benefits. And those are really high. It's not because, you know, the workers are getting, they get health care, and that's a good thing. The reason why the cost is so high, though, is our health care system's broken. So we pay about twice as much per person as Canada, Germany, pick your country. We don't have anything obvious to show for that in terms of better health care outcomes. We have shorter life expectancies. We have higher infant mortality rates. You look at most measures of outcomes, we do worse than most countries. So we have a really bad, broken, inefficient healthcare system that's added hugely to the cost of the auto industry, and that's certainly a factor in their problems today. I should also point out there's been a number that's been widely used, and it's very misleading. You see often in the media that auto workers get paid 70 or 75 an hour in compensation. And that's an extremely misleading number, because the way that number's arrived at is the big three have legacy costs for workers that used to work there, workers who are now retired. They pay their pensions, they pay their health care. Well, they average those expenses over their current workforce. And that's how you get to $70 or $75 an hour. So you're counting the health care benefits that they're paying to workers who have already retired. Now, that's really a cost to General Motors, no doubt about it. I mean, that's money they have to pay. But that's not money going to a worker today. And it's been really irresponsible that newspapers have just printed that unquestioningly, because, you know, I would say if I thought the workers were getting $75 an hour, I'd probably say that's kind of high. You know, that is a lot of money. That the 28 an hour doesn't bother me. 75 an hour, I'd say it's kind of high. And the reality is that's a cost to GM, but that's not what's going to the workers. Most of that, or I shouldn't say most of that, a very large portion of that is what's going to retirees due to commitments that General Motors made 10, 20 years ago.
Talk about your thoughts on the incoming Obama administration in terms of those that he's chosen for his economic team.
Well, I'd say it's a mixed bag. To be negative, start on the bad side, you know, he's picked a lot of the people who were partly responsible for getting us here. Larry Summers has to stand out prominently in that. He was Treasury Secretary in the Clinton administration. He held top positions there. He supported a lot of the policies of financial deregulation, the high dollar policy that gave us this huge trade deficit. He thought asset bubbles, at that time the big bubble was the stock bubble, obviously preceding the housing bubble. He thought that was just fine. You know, we shouldn't worry about those. So he supported a lot of the policies that got us here. The Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner, also was in on a lot of these policies as a Treasury official in the Clinton administration. And more recently, his role has been less than stellar in the bailouts to date. He's chair of the New York Fed, and in that role, he's been right in the middle of many of the bailouts. For example, the bailout of AIG, the huge insurance company, which doesn't seem to be going that well. Now, I don't know we could blame that all on Timothy Geithner, but, you know, it doesn't particularly speak well, that, you know, it's not gone well. And again, maybe that's not his fault. I don't have all the details on that, so I can't really say, but it's not a real big success story that you could point to. So those are certainly grounds for concern. Some of the other people are very, very good. I was very happy to see Peter Orszag, who's currently the director of the Congressional Budget Office, picked as head of the Office of Management and Budget. He's a very smart guy, very attentive to details. And what I've really appreciated is, in his role at the Congressional Budget Office, he's really focused on health care front and center. And a point that Peter's made many times, and I think it can't be repeated enough, is that our budget problems, when we look out and say, okay, what are we going to do with the budget, you know, 10, 20 years out, and there's a lot of people talking about that, those are really health care problems. It's not really the budget. The budget's really pretty much okay. We have a problem with our health care system, and we pay for half of our health care, half of the country's health care, through the budget, through the government, through programs like Medicare and Medicaid and other government health care programs. So if we don't fix our health care system, we're going to have enormous budget problems 10, 20 years out, because health care is going to cost the government so much money. On the other hand, if we fix the health care system, and that's what he's focused on, then, you know, our budget problems are very manageable. So I thought he was a very, very good pick for President Obama, and I was glad to see him given a top position. Also, some of the other picks suggest that health care reform is going to be a top priority for the Obama administration, which, again, I'm very happy about, because clearly we have to do that, both to provide people with health care, because we do have 47 million people that don't have health care insurance, but secondly, to have rationalized the system, have a system where we can begin to contain costs so it doesn't impose such a great burden on both the government and also the private sector, as we're seeing with the big three.
How much of our economic woes do you feel are attributable to the deregulation that's been going throughout different industries?
Well, certainly most of what we're seeing today was due to, I don't know if I'd say deregulation, I sort of like to say misregulation of the financial sector, because one of the stories here is we never really deregulated the industry fully, in the sense the government always has been very heavily involved in the financial industry. You know, for example, you go to the bank, your deposit's insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. You know, there's many other ways in which the government's involved, but the biggest way in which it's involved is what we're seeing right now, that we have the too big to fail doctrine, that when things really go badly, the government steps in and doesn't just allow the system to collapse. And we all kind of knew that, you know, and what's really going on, the too big to fail, in effect, is a form of insurance. The regulation that we put on the banks so that they don't get involved in very speculative activities is designed, in effect, to limit the cost of the insurance. It's sort of like if we have, you know, insurance on our house, and the insurance company says, well, we really don't want you to have a steel welding operation there. You know, well, they'd say, if you want to have a steel welding operation, you're going to have to pay a lot more for your insurance. Well, it's the same sort of thing with the financial system. The nature of the regulation was, we are insuring them. The government is involved with the financial system. And what the industry was doing, they weren't saying, we don't want regulation in the sense, oh, forget the too big to fail doctrine. Don't give us money. You know, just tell everyone you're going to let us go under. They never said that. What they were saying is that they wanted insurance without having to pay for it. So it was one-sided deregulation, and that certainly laid the path for, you know, the situation we got into. And what I'd say first and foremost, though, you know, apart from the specifics of were we regulating credit default swaps and the various complex financial instruments, first and foremost was the Federal Reserve Board failed in attacking the financial bubbles head-on. So in the 90s, we had a $10 trillion stock bubble, and Greenspan said quite explicitly, he thought, you know, you just sit back and go, well, bubbles come, bubbles go, and, you know, I heard him give a talk where he was very proud of himself. He said, we did the right thing. We just let the stock bubble collapse of its own, and then we picked up the pieces. And clearly, he had the same attitude towards the housing bubble. And that's absolutely disastrous, because as we see, picking up the pieces is not a lot of fun. So it was an enormous failure. He could have stopped the housing bubble, and he made a decision, you know, I don't have access to his thoughts, but, you know, there was a decision made to just let the bubble grow and let it go of its own accord, and, you know, that creates the disastrous economic situation we're in today.
So you'd see that as one of the responsibilities of the Fed to regulate things like that?
Absolutely. I mean, Greenspan, and I should say most economists, I shouldn't really just pick on Greenspan, obviously he's chair of the Fed, but most economists, I mean, he had a lot of support for this, that when Greenspan announced his retirement from the Federal Reserve Board, they devoted this meeting of central bankers. Every year they have a meeting in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, of central bankers, and they devoted the meeting in the summer of 05, Greenspan's last, to a Greenspan retrospective. And they were, you know, feting Alan Greenspan, and one of the papers debated whether he was the greatest central banker of all time. I mean, so he had widespread support in the economics profession. So, I mean, obviously he was the guy in charge, but this was the widely held view that, you know, bubbles come, bubbles go, don't worry about it. And, you know, to my mind, I would just flip that on its head. There was absolutely nothing Alan Greenspan did in his period, his 17 years at the Federal Reserve Board, that would have been more important than, one, preventing the stock bubble, and, two, preventing the housing bubble. This idea that these are just, you know, minor things that come and go is nuts. And, as I say, I think most people would be inclined to agree with that today. It's unfortunate that, you know, the economist in a position to do something about it didn't say anything, say, 5 or 6 years ago.
I get the impression from reading your blog, Beat the Press, that you see that a lot of the corporate media keeps using the term credit crisis when they should be using the term housing bubble.
There's still a remarkable reluctance to see what exactly has happened here. So, you know, to my mind, the basic story is very simple. People saw their house prices crash. And on the one hand, that has a direct effect on the housing market, construction. If you could sell a house for only 60%, 70% of what you could have sold for 5 years ago, you're less likely to build one. I mean, that's a basic story there. But more importantly, people aren't consuming because they don't have money. They had, you know, people across the country that thought they had 100, 200,000 equity in their home, and they've seen much or all of that disappear. And we get the media talking about credit crunches, people can't borrow, and you go, well, no, they can't borrow. They can't borrow because no bank's going to lend someone money with no collateral. So if you or I go down to the bank and we say we want to take out a loan for a car or we want a credit card, and they see you have $150,000 of equity in your home, they'll go, sure, you know, that's great, because before you default on your credit card debt, you're going to draw down your $150,000 equity in your home. So that's a real safe deal for them. On the other hand, if we go down to the bank and they say, well, what do you have? And we owe $10,000 more than our home's worth, they're not going to be anxious to give us a credit card or give us a car loan. So this really isn't a story of a credit crunch. It's quite simply we've lost on the order of $6 trillion in housing wealth at this point. I think we're probably going to lose about another $2 or $3 trillion more. And that's caused this huge fall off in consumption that's throwing us into a recession. So the problem isn't that the banks don't have the money to lend, and many don't, but the problem is first and foremost that people don't have the money to support their spending.
Do you think the difference in terms there also kind of lays the blame at different doorsteps?
It does two things. It lays the blame at different doorsteps, and secondly, in terms of going forward, you know, what are the solutions? Well, if you think the problem is a credit crunch, well, then let's get more money to the financial sector. You know, let's straighten that out, help out our banks so that they could again begin to make the loans. If you say the problem is people don't have money to buy cars, to buy other things, well, giving the banks more money in that story really doesn't help much. You know, so if I've just lost all the equity in my home, I'm probably not going to want to go out and buy another car. I have to do some savings. You know, if a lot of people, this ties into another issue. We have this huge baby boom cohort, many, some already in their 60s, most of them in their 50s. They're not far from retirement. Many of them, most of them, have almost nothing saved up for retirement. They don't have traditional pensions. They have virtually nothing in 401ks, IRAs. They've just lost the equity in their home. These people are thinking about, you know, what could they do to put something aside for their retirement? I mean, it's great we have Social Security. It's hugely important we have Social Security, but they'd like to have something in addition to that. And if you're 55 and you've got nothing, it's probably a good idea to start thinking about putting some money aside. So the main reason people aren't saving now is they don't have money. And fixing the banks, giving the banks more money so they could lend it out, that's not going to help that story. The best way to help that story is to have the government spend money. That's really what has to boost the economy right now. So I think it's both a question of shifting the blame that, you know, this weird thing happened with the financial system, we have this credit crunch as opposed to a housing bubble that was easily foreseeable and could have been rectified long ago and prevented this problem. And secondly, that helping the financial system at this point is not going to cure the problems.
So if you were tapped by the Obama administration to become the economic czar, what would you implement to fix the current crisis?
Well, I think the key thing is to spend lots of money, and I've been really happy to see that President Obama looks to be going that way. And, you know, I know that sounds silly, spend money, but in this case, that's really exactly what you have to do, because the basic story is that we used to be spending a lot of money. We, as, you know, a country, were spending a lot of money through through consumption. We thought we had all this money in the housing market, and based on that, people in some cases were borrowing directly against the equity of their home, or in other cases just saying they don't have to save because their house price is going up 10% every year, so they were happy to go out and spend money on cars, vacations, whatever it might be. Well, now that that equity has disappeared, people stop spending. So how do you make that up? The only real way to do that is for the government to come out and spend lots and lots of money. So President Obama is talking about a stimulus package on the order of $250 to $350 billion a year. I think that's the right direction. We might actually need more money in that. He's also, to my mind, talking about directing it for the most part very much the right way, that ideally we want to spend this money in ways that will have long-term payoffs. So he's talking about spending on infrastructure, rebuilding our infrastructure, opening up broadband, putting up money for broadband so that we have universal broadband, spending it on retrofits to reduce energy consumption, green retrofitting, so we reduce our energy consumption, putting some of it in healthcare, aid to state and local governments so they have to make cutbacks. It's a very good way to get money directly into the economy. So he's going in the right direction. You know, there's a lot more to be worked out in terms of the specifics, but he's very much, you know, got the agenda right, the general direction right, so I was very glad to see that.
And how would that affect the deficit? Is a larger growing deficit, is that in this case a good thing then?
Absolutely. I mean, we're in a situation where for 2009, 2010, the bigger problem would be if the deficit's too small. We have to spend lots of money. And there's a lot of confusion on this. People are thinking, oh, we're going to create this really big burden on our children. And it's just, it's really kind of a sloppiness. I mean, a lot of people promoted this sloppiness as an excuse to tax Social Security and Medicare. But it's a sloppiness in how we think about the deficit. Because when we spend money in normal times, the classic story is to how the deficit's going to be bad for our children or grandchildren. So let's say the economy's close to its capacity, and unemployment rate's 4%, and we're going along very strong growth. If we spend money and create a larger deficit in that context, the story we would tell is that we're pulling it away from other sectors of the economy. We're going to push up interest rates. That means we're going to be investing less. We'll have less wealth in the future. That's not the story we're in right now. No one could think that by spending $400 billion, $500 billion this year or next, that we're somehow pulling it away from somewhere. The question is whether the government spends it or it doesn't get spent at all and we just have higher unemployment. And in this story, if the government's spending the money, and particularly if it's spending in ways that have the character of investment, so that we're building a better infrastructure so that we could, you know, we'll be more efficient in the future, or we're building green infrastructure so we'll use less energy in the future, in that case, that's going to have a long-term payoff. You know, or education, another example where it'd have a long-term payoff. That's going to make us wealthier in the future, not poorer. And in terms of private investment, no one's going to invest money. You look at factory utilization rates, they're through the floor. You know, the auto industry, they're not going to be investing in building new plant. They can't operate their existing plant. They don't have the demand for that. So by spending money, increasing demand, that's going to actually increase investment, not decrease it. So at this point, we don't have to worry about deficits somehow being a burden on our children. It's really quite the opposite. If we don't spend the money, that will be more of a burden on our children.
Yeah, I know here locally that the amount of infrastructure we need to replace is phenomenal, from our roads to our water pipes to, like, everything we use on a daily basis.
Yeah, we've been really negligent in doing a lot of necessary maintenance. I mean, a lot of the, you know, the classic story is the one in Minnesota with the bridge collapsing. The story there was that we had a bridge that we knew needed maintenance, but we deferred that, and it collapsed. You know, hopefully we won't get more like that. But the point is, we've been very neglectful in keeping our infrastructure up to date. Now, also, I should just say, I mean, we should be conscious of where we're spending the money. The idea is not to pave the country over. One of the things we should be looking to do is have smart projects that encourage, you know, filling in areas rather than the sort of suburban sprawl we've been seeing over the last two decades. So when we're building our infrastructure, it's not just to pave the country. We should be thinking very consciously about how we design a good infrastructure for the 21st century that allows us to have a more energy-efficient economy, more concentrated living rather than the sort of sprawl we've been seeing. That's something, again, this is in many ways an opportunity. We could do a lot of things that would have been much more difficult to do if the economy hadn't gone into this sort of slump.
We are talking with Dean Baker. He is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. And, Dean, can people, if they want to find out more about some of the ideas you've proposed, can they find out more via your website?
Yeah, people can go to our website at www.cepr.net. Again, that's www.cepr.net. I also should say my book, The Conservative Nanny State, is available. It can be available for free download on the web at www.conservativenannystate.org.
Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Again, just talking with Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and you can find out more via their website, cepr.net, and his website, conservativenannystate.org.